I think I put down as my topic what works in women's education, but since I sent my topic in, I got in the New York Times Magazine one whole issue on why women's rights are the cause of our time. And there's a very, very interesting article by Nicholas Kristof and his wife, Sherry Woodin. And they say the oppression of women worldwide is the human rights cause of our time. And their liberation could help solve many of the world's problems, from poverty to child mortality to terrorism. It's a 21st century manifesto. And I'm just going to read a few statistics that they had. The UN estimated there are 5,000 honor killings a year, the majority in the Muslim world. 1% of the world's landowners are women. 98% of the people in Egypt say they believe that girls have the same right to education as boys. 98%. And I guess those are the statistics. One other one that I was quite amazed about is the disappeared women. Women live longer than men usually. So like in the United States, there are 97 men to every 100 women. And that is true throughout most of the world. But in China, India, and Pakistan, where women have a longer life expectancy, there are 107 men to every 100 women. And they call them the disappeared women.
Interesting.
In some cases, they found, especially in India, with the more wealthy people who can afford ultrasound, they abort their women, their girls. Maybe not the first one, but after the first one, any of them. In some of the places, they really don't know what's happening. So they call them the disappeared women.
Didn't they used to do that in China? Oh, they just kind of drowned them down the old river.
And they've done studies in some of these countries where the boys will get medical help if it's all available and the girls don't. And in quite a few places, of course, the boys get the best food. And one of the things Nicholas Kristof and his wife talk about is that because they want a boy to support them, but actually girls take better care of their parents than the sons do. So if they're thinking about their old age, their girls are more reliable. So I was just going to, this is, if you're interested further, this is the best book I know of, What Works in Girls' Education. And I thought that we would just start talking about it, and I really, really want a discussion today.
Who's put that out?
This is put out by the Council on Foreign Relations from, it's an independent national membership organization and a nonprofit. And they don't take any position on policy issues, and it has no affiliation with the U.S. government. It's research, and they put that out. So, Kristof, they are, their book is coming out this month, and it's called Half the Sky. One little story he has in there, Bill Gates was in Saudi Arabia, and he was addressing a group of scientists and people into technology, and about one-fifth were women, and the others were men, and they were divided by kind of a wall. And they were saying that in the next 10 years, they want Saudi Arabia to be one of the top 10 countries in the world in the development of technology. And Bill Gates said it'll never happen if you don't use, if you only use half your population. And they said a big cheer broke out on this side with all of these women who were wearing chadors and you couldn't see their faces, but they were. So if we want to do that, we have to educate girls. In the world, there are probably 104 million children aged 6 to 11 that aren't in school.
Wow. How many again?
Probably about 104 million. And there are 150 million kids in school who drop out before they finish primary school. And most of these will be girls. And in sub-Saharan Africa, more than half of the girls don't ever complete a primary school education. In Chad, 90% of the girls haven't. Where Greg is working in Pakistan and Baltistan, about 1% of the women were literate when he started. Should be a little better now because there's a few more girls going to school, but that's really, really low.
The night I dropped mine, remember? Did you hear? So I need him to buy a circle one.
You know, if I could just share a tiny little story.
Well,
right
this
now.
Is what I want you to
okay.
do.
I was blessed to go to Sierra Leone about, less than a week or two after the war, their civil war ended, which was the war where the hands and maiming of all the people, that sort of thing, so I saw that. But I'll never forget the sight as we left on the ferry in order to get across the bay to the airport. And it was about 5 o'clock in the evening, and right over underneath a stairway, sitting just together, was a little group of children, and a young man who had been doing some kind of work during the day had come to teach those children. And pretty soon they started to sing the ABC, they knew we were Americans, and they started to sing the ABC songs for us, you know, and went through that. But that's what they were doing right after the war. They were so interested to keep the education going for the children. They didn't have schools and they didn't have teachers, you know. But those who were educated would just gather the children wherever and rote teach them, you know. And I'll never forget that sight of a person taking the time to teach the children, to teach
sure.
education. And then I think of our kids who sit in the schools and don't. I wish they weren't there or something.
I know my granddaughter, after visiting Pakistan, said, here we think school is you have to, and there they think I get to. That this alarms me. At least one out of every three girls completing primary school in Africa and South Asia cannot effectively read, write, or do simple arithmetic. And a lot of that has to do with they're not in school enough. So the benefits of girls' education. Higher wages. Faster economic growth. This one I thought was really interesting, but farming improves. And then educating girls leads to smaller, more sustainable families. They've done a lot of research in Bangladesh because it's over 20 years ago, they really made a huge, huge push for education for everybody. And the birth rate is now leveling off. And Bangladesh is still a very, very poor country but the people are better off than they were before. Educating women saves children's lives. Each year of girls' education can reduce infant mortality by 5 to 10%.
Well, you know what I think is really neat out of our last churchwide assembly, the fact that we now have our next social statement is going to be on the justice of women, and there's going to be a study done on that. But it was interesting, there was somebody from one of my sister synods in Texas, this lady, who stood up and said she didn't think we should be wasting our money on a study for women's justice, that the women have enough justice in them. I couldn't believe that they quoted her on that. I see that quote in the Lutheran, I don't know. But so I'm excited about that. And I've been working with the 1325 resolution out of the UN, which we were challenged in Salt Lake City at the Women's Convention there by Sister Chitra. I can never say her name.
Chitra.
Yeah, Chitra. And the fact that this was passed in 2000 by the UN and many countries have signed on to it, but the United States.
And nothing much happened out of it. I mean, this was supposed to be it, and here we are 9 years down the line. Educating women promotes educating children. If you educate a man, he may or may not, depending upon income, see that his children are educated. But educated mothers do. And then one of the big things they have found in Africa especially, it reduces HIV and AIDS. Educated women are far less likely to contract AIDS. In Zambia, they are finding AIDS is spreading twice as fast among uneducated girls. And in Uganda, the HIV AIDS rate is 1/3 for girls who finished secondary school. So it's one of the most effective ways of doing that. So
it sounds to me like under all the statistics and things, it sounds like they've done a lot, enough studies, that we wouldn't, instead of needing more studies on about women, that we need action and
action
to help them.
And that's what can you do? Well, one thing they have found is fees for tuition in Africa, poorer parts of Asia, can amount to 10% of a household income. And a lot of people just simply cannot afford it. Tanzania, a few years ago, dropped the fees for primary school, so it's free now. And enrollment went up double.
But they still have to buy uniforms and shoes and things.
That
still makes it very difficult for something.
That's the indirect fees. The indirect fees are sometimes you have to pay something extra for the teacher or things like that, and the indirect costs are exactly what you're talking about. And the costs may be greater for girls than for boys because they need to ensure modesty or meet cultural requirements. And this is an issue in Pakistan. After they finish primary school in the village, if they go to a middle school in a nearby village, they have to have an escort.
Oh.
Unless there's a big group of girls going. So that's
an
expense.
And in Pakistan it's totally separate. There's boys' schools and girls' schools. There's no mixed schools.
No, there are mixed schools. But they have separate classes, for the most part. I have seen a mullah teaching the Quran, and the boys sit on one side of him and the girls on the other. So it's that kind of separation, even though they're together. Well, what works making school affordable. And Bangladesh, which made a huge push on that. Pakistan, which they were one country at one time, but Pakistan spends an enormous amount of money on their military. And that has a lot to do with Kashmir, but who's ever heard of the Bangladesh military? I'm sure they have one, but they had a female secondary school stipend in Bangladesh, and it covered their tuition, their books, their uniforms, and transportation for secondary school girls. And in the areas where they did it, the enrollment was twice the national average. So they're hoping and planning to go to free school through 12th grade.
I think one of the problems too is that in many countries, I can speak for Liberia for sure, but I think it's true in other countries, the UN will provide educational material, but only up through sixth grade. And then that's the problem. You know, they'll have the books and all the charts and everything needed to teach, but only up through sixth grade. And that's why when you're saying about primary school, that's where a lot of people get lost after that.
But if you do have up to a fifth grade education, it will do these things like lower the birth rate, lower the death rate, improve the farming, but it isn't enough.
Start.
Our pastor said that in villages in India, where they had hooked TV up to a battery, and enough people could watch in the evening, it dramatically lowered the birth rate.
But that would be another.
But I was just thinking, if you had like a community or a better quality TV, and that was also interesting, educational TV, that.
Building local schools with community support and flexible schedules, and that community support is a big thing Greg does in the schools. It's like Habitat. Mm-hmm. You know, if the people have sweat equity in their houses, mm-hmm. and with Central Asia Institute, the villagers have to donate the land, all materials that can be gotten locally, and most of the schools are built of stone, which is an enormous amount of backbreaking work. They haul the stones in and then hew them so that they will fit together. But
then there's ownership to it.
There's ownership
to it. And there's pride to it. And I think that's part of the problem that we've had to learn, is that we don't go in and say, here's your school, this is the way you're supposed to run it. You know, we've got to learn to accompany, as the church says.
In Egypt, they built new schools in rural areas, and the boys' enrollment went up by 19%. Girls' enrollment went up 60%, because parents would send their boys further away to go to school, but they wouldn't their girls. So it really made a difference there. In the on my laptop with my PowerPoint, I'll show tomorrow night, there's a school in Pakistan, in Hushe. And if there is no school at all in Central Asia Institute building school, the village has to commit to increasing the girls' enrollment by 10% a year until it's about even. And if they don't, then the stipends for the teachers and supplies will be dropped. Well, in Hushe, the first year they started with 11 kids, and I think they had 30 girls the next year. It just takes someone to get it started, and in no schools at all have they had trouble with that 10%. One of the villages, they had a school in the village elders were just opposed to girls going to school, and it just wasn't happening. And then some of the men found out from nearby villages, girls with education got a much higher bride price. Where you may get a couple of goats for a young uneducated girl, you get a yacht and some other things for an educated girl. And that was kind of the thing that sold some of the fathers on there. Providing preschool and child care programs appears promising. They're doing that in India and Kenya. And that seems to be something that is encouraging people to go to school. And to make schools more friendly, private latrine facilities are a must. And they have to be far enough away from the boys so the boys don't see the girls going to the latrine. And as I mentioned yesterday, many, many, many girls drop out of school when they start menstruating because they don't have any proper... And don't get me wrong, I'm not disparaging what Oprah did, but if she would have taken all that money and bought sanitary napkins, she could have all the girls in South Africa going to high school. Where a lot of them, you know, some of the things that, girls need privacy. And, you know, I think as we were here in the United States some years ago, they found teachers were calling on boys more, and they did a lot of things to stop that gender discrimination. Now they're finding it's going the other way. So they're saying they have to do more for boys here. Female teachers for girls, especially in Muslim countries, makes a big difference.
How many female teachers are in grade schools? I mean, when you talk about education...
Not very many.
Yeah, then
But it's going to increase huge because that first group of people have, of women have gone through... They started with some who'd only finished fifth grade to teach the younger children, but now they have a lot more women, and they're going to teacher training, so that's going to make a huge difference. And girls that are young women who've gone through the schooling and teacher training are far more apt to go back to their villages. The men with that, if they can get a job teaching in the city where they can make more money or something, men are much more apt to do that than the women. But it is making a difference, providing enough teachers. And they're making a really big push, get this. Who's been a teacher? Okay.
Yeah.
To limit the class size to 40.
Thank you.
Is that here or there?
Well, we're kind of going the other way.
Yeah, they are.
That the free textbooks make a huge difference.
So is the government of Pakistan, I mean, I'm going back to Pakistan.
Yeah, that's what I know most about.
And does the government there provide teaching aids or textbooks or nothing?
They do in their schools. There are government schools. Where Greg works in Baltistan, it's much like Puerto Rico. It's a protectorate. Mm. The people there don't vote like in national elections and things, so it's kind of...
Colony.
It's kind of just forgotten. So, and as I said, they just don't have much money, and so much of it is spent in the army. We got already 104 million children between 6 and 11 aren't in school. and there are 150 million children in the world who will drop out of school before they finish primary school, and most all of those are girls. Only 36 of the 155 developing countries have achieved 100% primary school finishing rates. So, well over 100 countries. The gender gap in primary school completion is greater than 10%. And in Africa, way over half the girls don't finish primary school or don't have any.
You know what I was kind of thinking is these gals that are going and getting education, when they get out and get married, they're going to push to see that their kids get education. So it'll start to snowball. It's one of those things going to take maybe 20 or 30 years to get it to roll. But I think probably that would hope that be the way it would go.
I think you're really right on. Greg always says probably three generations. But three generations in the third world isn't quite as long as three generations here.
It's about 45 years or something.
Do you know which country in the world has the most women in their government of any country in the world?
Mm-hmm. Norway or Sweden?
No.
Or India?
No. It's Rwanda.
Rwanda.
And partly because so many of the men died.
Oh.
But also, I think the women there, and as traumatized as they were, and as many rape victims as they are, the women really took a hold. And Rwanda is one of the countries that is really doing so much better now with education for girls and women. And as I said before, I think one of the really interesting things is this farming business, that women with at least a fifth grade education, the farming in their villages goes way up.
Do they tell why that happened?
Probably they learn some farming methods. They can read about things. I'm sure it makes a difference as far as selling your things. I'm going to do a little aside here. I heard someone saying, this was in Lebanon. They asked the first grader, what's a 5 plus 8, and he said, am I buying or am I selling? I think in Pakistan, women don't go to market and they don't do the marketing, but that is changing. And as women are getting into making clothes, knitting, and there's some examples that in the DVD I'm going to show tomorrow, they're raising the standard, and they're trading their own things. But when I was in Skardu, which is kind of like the provincial capital of Baltistan, I didn't see any women except the wives of the military and a few foreigners. But as they're producing their things, they will be taking it to market. If they're educated, they will know numbers, values, and that's all going to change. In fact, it is already that.
It's interesting, in Papua New Guinea, they want the children to be women because the women do all the work, all the farming work, all the everything work.
Yeah, that's
so they're happier to have women than they are to have sons, you know, girls and women, and the more they have, the more work they're gonna have. So the women are pregnant a lot because, I mean, you know, Dr. Mammy, who is, from Madagascar, who is a South-South missionary with the ELCA.
Yeah.
His big thing was birth control, because they kept having babies, because they wanted more people to work the fields, because it's mainly an agricultural society. But we were shocked. It was the women that they wanted to have girls.
They wanted girls.
It was the opposite of most of the rest of the world.
Yeah. I don't know.
I was thinking about North Dakota.
Yeah.
Way back at the, oh, the 1900s or thereabouts. The families, there was nothing to have. 12.
Right, exactly.
10 kids or whatever.
To take care of.
Because that was their,
Your livelihood.
Livelihood, yeah.
But they were probably converted boys.
Walking around, they had the thing on their head.
Yeah.
Carrying a baby in a bundle and the man would be walking.
With nothing.
Alongside her with nothing.
Yeah.
Women carried all the goods, everything. They did everything.
When you talk about farming, in the US, the rates of women who farmed got up. I mean, not people who work on farms, but who own farms. And there was an article in the Seattle paper a couple weeks ago, in the Sunday paper, about women organic farmers on these small, you know,
right.
5 to 10 acre.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they raise, you know, produce and do CSA boxes and stuff all year. And like, it was huge. I mean, like, the number of women that are now owning farms have gone up like 30%. And the number of men owning farms had stayed static over the last 5 years.
Well, maybe if they do another survey, then next year there'll be a little bit over 1% land ownership by women because of what they're
doing.
Yeah, right,
because of just the U.S.
In the U.S., uh-huh.
Oh, a lot of farms that were barely making it around the turn of the century, too. I've talked to a lot of women who worked their farms while their husbands went to town to take a job and stayed in town all week and came home on the weekends and brought in money while the woman ran the farm during the week. And, you know, carried the baby on the tractor and all that kind of thing.
It kind of sounds like Australia, the Aborigines. It was kind of interesting when we were lucky enough to get there.
Uh-huh.
But anyhow, to make a long story short, this guy had the paint on in his hair or whatever,
uh-huh.
And he was sitting there, and I was looking at a boomerang. I picked it up, and I said, how much is this? And he said, oh, I say, Yank. He said, that's £3. And I said, well, that was very nice, thank you. And I said,
dollars.
And I said, you speak English really well. He said, I'm a Harvard graduate. He said, I come up here on the weekends just to help the wife out, but look at this. Well, he looked like he just come right out of the brush, but here's this guy, college education. I said, what do you do? He said, oh, I'm an accountant.
I feel like our story of our maverick when he's one of our doctors.
Mm-hmm.
Medic.
But the wife had the business,
and
they
really was helping him.
Doing very well.
They've got case after case here. Uganda, when they cut fees in primary schools, enrollment jumped 70%. In Malawi, when they reduced fees, it went up 63%. Attendance, as I said, in Tanzania doubled. When I lived in Tanzania in the 60s, there was a boys' secondary school and a co-ed secondary school in that, I don't know how many people were there. Now there are high school, secondary schools all over the place. They're still the two government schools, but they're setting up schools all over, private ones. And they're not exorbitant, but they're expensive, but they are crowded. One of the things when we were there, the tribe that lives on Mount Kilimanjaro, the Chaga, they have always been a very, let me say, progressive people. And when we were there in the 60s, at eighth grade, you had to take an exam to go to high school. Chaga would buy the name of kids who had passed from other tribes. So. Here would come these kids to high school who looked Chaga, but they had a Iramba name or something. And I don't think that's going on anymore, but it was widespread at the time. If your child hadn't scored high enough to go on, you just bought someone's name.
Well, the ELCA has been served there, I don't know if it was a target country, but Tanzania and Namibia seem to be the ones I've seen the ELCA has many impact on those two.
And they had some direct schools they had, but the teacher training, well, where we were, it was at Morongo Teacher Training Institute, and they have had an impact.
Because the reason I brought that up, because our University Lutheran in Seattle, I think we had a like a four-person group go over to one or two Lutheran, I don't know if they call it middle school or high school, or the same or whatever, but they have a Lutheran high school, and we're sort of as a church congregation supporting their school.
And those, and those church ones too are springing up all over. So high school has become very, very desirable for both boys and girls, but there's still far more boys going to school than girls in Tanzania too.
And then some of those go on to come to the United States, don't they, as college students. Now, does anybody ever come from Pakistan to the United States?
Central Asia Institute has one person, a remarkable young woman. She has a teaching degree, and she 2 years ago finished her law degree and passed the bar. She speaks very good English, but this last year she has been at Montana State, and she is going to head up Central Asia Institute's scholarship program and decide which girls in Pakistan will go on to scholarship. And it was kind of interesting, they had, they were talking to young women in her village, and there are a lot of them that want to go on scholarship, but they said, not like Fawzia to the USA, that's too far for us, we're not that brave, but they would like to go in Pakistan. That and well, it's going to make a difference.
I heard a Middle Eastern woman who had graduated from the University of Utah say that her father, the University of Utah, was the only place he let her go.
Oh,
because
Mormon.
Mormons, and he felt that they were family friendly. The male was the head of the household, and she, I mean, she, well, she had her choice of the University of Brigham Young.
He must have known quite a bit about U.S.
That's what I was thinking.
Demographics,
I mean, you know,
or
that for oil-rich Arab to know about the University of Utah.
They found too, the further the school is away, the less likely a girl would be to go to school. And in Baltistan, the villages are too small and too far apart to have anything more than a primary school. So what Central Asia Institute is doing right now is they're building a boarding facility in Skardu. And there's a government high school there where the girls can go if they score high enough in their exams, and they've been doing very, very well. And then they're going to hire several widows to go, and that will give these women income. And that they will go and be the house mothers or whatever you say.
So the government has no problem with Greg schools, with the, I shouldn't say Greg schools, but the schools that he's helped found for going into the high schools or into
That's strictly on how you score in the tests. And I don't know what these numbers mean. But
so they take the government test to
get
into
school.
They take
the government test after 5th grade, after 8th grade, after 10th grade, but after 5th grade, the national average is 49. The last I heard, the average for CAI schools was 76. A lot of those headmasters keep them, they go to school Friday morning and then are released to go to prayers. have school on Saturday, they have school on Sunday. So they're going 6.5 days a week, come out of them. And the kids want to. There's a little more problem there with boys' attendance than girls because of herding the goats. So what they do is the boys take turns, and maybe a couple of them will go one day, and then the other kids help them catch up with that. So, but it's a huge problem, and it's something that could be taken care of if our mind was set to it. I don't know if this is true or not, but Greg heard or was telling me that if you take the smallest coin in every country, there's enough of them to educate every child in the world to a primary school level. Hmm. And just what the whole pennies program, you know, 100 million pennies, $1 million worth of pennies, that goes a long way in supporting schools. And I think it just has to be a huge push, and especially for women. Now, what's our time? Oh, gosh, only 10 minutes. Let's talk about gender education. And those of you that were here yesterday, when I said when my daughter is getting married, my son-in-law, who'd gone all through parochial schools, asked her, does your mother have an opinion on parochial schools? And so he said, my mother has opinions on everything. On separate gender education, I don't know what's best. And I'd like to hear, you know, there are schools now that are having just boys. Mm-hmm.
Especially at a certain age.
At certain age, and they're finding the boys do better.
Well, in Seattle, they had two Catholic schools, O'Day and Seattle Prep. It was solid boys at each one, not anymore. But it was back when I
was O'Day
still
is.
O'Day
still is.
Seattle Prep.
Seattle Prep.
It's two
granddaughters.
This is way back probably in the 30s, 40s, and early 50s.
Also in girls' schools. Yes. There's a girls' middle school in Seattle, and there's another one that's starting out in Shoreline. And they're finding that that these girls do very, very well. One year moved from Faith with her, did really well, really appreciated, and has gone on now to a girls' high school. She did Holy Names for high school, you know, and really appreciates the kind of freedom that gives them to really concentrate on their learning and not be distracted by some of the other, mm-hmm. not just by boys, but I mean, it's just kind of the whole social scene that comes with co-ed mm-hmm. education.
Was that a religious school, or was that a public school?
No, the middle school, Seattle Girls School. It's called Seattle Girls School.
Is it a
public school? It's middle school. Yeah,
it's private.
Holy Names is Catholic high school, but that's all girls.
Holy Names, Greg spoke there a few years ago.
Oh, really? Cool.
Yeah, he said when he speaks at girls' schools, it's just terrific because they get it. when I was principal in River Falls, there was a first grade, we did lots of cooperative learning. And there was a first grade teacher who was trying different things out, and she said she found when she had reading with a cooperative group, just put the kids together and they helped each other and things. She said in math, she ability grouped, because in math, the kids who were really good at it would do everything. Mm-hmm. And the other kids weren't learning from mm-hmm. each other mm-hmm. like in reading. Mm-hmm. And she separated the genders in science because she said the boys just totally took over any science project they were doing. So I don't know if that would hold true, but that's what she found out.
You know, I'm wondering too, now there's so much that kids do after school, and they used to just go back to the farm, and that I think that maybe some of the after school activity that girls and boys do together may be a distraction, whether they were just going to school and going to class, and returning to their families, that maybe that it wouldn't be as much distraction as looking forward to all the socializing.
One of my questions is on this is when hearing about the Taliban, who they grow, those boys are growing up in an all-male atmosphere, have no connection with girls whatsoever, with girls, women. And then you read the societies that have more women than men, and where women have more rights are the least violent. So I don't know what that means. Maybe it doesn't mean anything for gender education. And I don't know if you found this, but when I looked at the community schools on the reservations, it's 85% women enrolled. I don't know what it's like here, but in the Midwest, overwhelmingly, and I don't know where that leaves the men.
Well, I don't know. Ours are public schools, and ended up probably the last two generations of students in the Puget Sound area. I can only, basically speak for our Skokomish, but they ended up before alcohol used to be the main deterrent, but drugs are the more deterrent now than young people than alcohol has ever been. But, I see for myself as my opinion would be that it's how the family values become, and if the family values are strong, the amount of children in our family going to school.
And I hear what you're saying. I was thinking of the community colleges that are on the reservations.
There's only one community college in north up by Everett, and Northwest Indian College. And I think your enrollment is like around 500, and I don't know what to do. The differentiation of men and women.
In the Midwest, they're overwhelmingly women. And when I was on the Menominee Reservation, it was 85%.
Wow.
And I don't know. I really don't know. I think I would have liked to have gone to an all-girls school. But I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, just anecdotally, the women I know who have gone to girls' high schools have been very grateful for the experience and are tend to be, you know, high achievers and leaders. And they're usually, I know at least three people, and they're pretty articulate about why they appreciated that.
And I think of St. Catherine's College in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Yeah, right. That's
all kinds of leadership is coming out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And has for years.
Mm-hmm.
But my more recent question is, what does it do for the boys? They achieve better, but if we're needing women in Pakistan and Afghanistan to lessen the violence.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting what parents do with gender. This is just a little anecdotal. But I was teaching in a suburb of Dallas, Texas, kindergarten. And we don't get snow very often in Dallas. And we had this one quite large snowfall. And I made it to the school, but you know, the whole city just stops dead in their tracks. So I came to the school, and that morning, I'm here to tell you that out of all our kindergartens, out of my kindergarten class, how many children do you think came that morning?
Probably all the girls.
Five boys.
Five boys.
And no girls. And so I had a morning, I had a class of five boys.
Five kids.
And did I ever have fun? I took them outside and we made a circle, we played fox and geese. I taught them all the little games that I knew. But I'll never forget that morning. But one mother even brought her little boy on a sled. But five boys came and nobody else. No girls.
I really would recommend, just from what I've read in the synopsis is the half the sky, where they're talking about the necessity of the human rights cause of our time is the liberation of women.
That's, yeah. You know, way back when Gloria Steinem first gave her glory, some guy said, women getting equal rights is the most revolutionary proposal the world has ever had to deal with. And this is far greater than revolutions for democracy or for religious ideals or anything else. And I thought, at the time, but now I look at a lot of the religious extremism in the Middle East, a big tenet of it being women being kept in an unequal position. And I wonder if he wasn't right.
I think we have to look at that, though, even though they do it in the name of Islam, it's political.
Yeah.
Because the Quran is for equal rights. Women should inherit, women should have knowledge.
I didn't mean that it was fundamentally religious. I meant that religious fundamentalists.
Okay. Yeah. I think it's 5 o'clock. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
What can we do to see that the women are educated?
I was so excited.
What can we do to see that the women of the world become educated?
Just keep the topic subject going.
Support scholarship funds if you can. I mean, I support one for Liberia. It's not just girls, but girls are I don't know what the percentage is, but the ones that I'm working with, there's a high percentage of girls. And we have a Lutheran scholarship fund program. Anybody's interested? I mean, sometimes it's only $5 for a year. The most is $75 a year, you know, is what it costs for them to go to school. But I mean, I'm sure there's other, I mean, the Institute. Other places that.
In Pakistan, it costs $12 a year for a primary student, $20 a year for secondary school.
So, I mean, all of us kind of, even if we don't have that much, I mean, $12 a year is $1 a month. What of us can't do that. So, I mean, there's ways that we can do it and promote it and keep it at the forefront of the topic.
I would hate to see something start and die again like the Year of the Women did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And I know wearing the burqa or chador is an issue here. When Greg talks to women in Pakistan and Afghanistan, they have two wishes. One, that their babies won't die, and two, that their girls can go to school. And he thought they'd ask maybe for a good husband or land, a farm or something, but it's those two things he hears over and over again.
A woman spoke in our church that had been in the Peace Corps in Afghanistan, and in the villages, the women couldn't afford burqas. They couldn't afford that much material. And so therefore, it was like an issue of pride to be able to have one. And she and some of her fellow Peace Corps workers actually gave this older woman who'd been poor all the way a burqa before they left, because then, and she was very, very happy.
And they really, I have to let you go, but it really started with a thing of pride, because it was the wealthy women in Saudi Arabia who wore them so the common people couldn't gaze upon them. And so, if you could do that, then you were
benefits.
And then it became a religious thing. Only having your hands and face show, and some of you have talked to about that before. I talked to some Muslim women and said, yes, you need to be a hajib with only your hands and face, and other women said, no, that isn't... One woman said she doesn't wear the dupatta that often, but she always carries it with her because it's very feminine to have a scarf. So thank you. And thanks for being our hope and
Yeah, you're welcome.
I didn't see.
Oh.